Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So, Bob Dylan.
Yes, Bob Dylan has, he's banned the use of telephones, isn't he? Of phones, of people having phones in the audience at his concerts, which is fair enough. When you get to one of his gigs now, your phone is, well, not confiscated, but you have to hand it over, don't you? And put it in a bag and you're not allowed to use it until you pick it up later. And do you know what? I kind of have a lot of... I've got a bit of sympathy with him, actually, for various reasons. I mean, one is, clearly, he's trying to, he's trying to kind of stop very lo-fi, poor quality clips of his set going out and ruining the surprise of some of the songs he's playing, etc. But more importantly, what must it be like when you get on stage and you stare at a forest of iPhones? Which you do, don't you? I mean, you see any clip of anybody, you're going to look at the Stones in Hyde Park. I mean, you can't see the Stones for a great mass of people holding phones up. And that must be very dispiriting as a performer, don't you think?
I think he's absolutely right. I can't believe nobody's done it before.
I know, really. I know.
Has he actually explained why this is being done? But I'm sure you're right about those reasons. And I think it is mainly the latter rather than the former. It's just, you're performing for a bunch of people who manifestly, half of whom are manifestly not paying attention. They're doing something different. Yeah. You know, it's as if they were writing down what you were saying or something. You know, they wouldn't do that. It could be a lot harder to do.
Well, we had the same experience, didn't we? We went to Wimbledon. We talked about
this.
The
other
day.
Is just what I was going to say. You know, we were in the very best seats on centre court in Wimbledon, watching Nadal in a wonderful game, and there were two women, particularly right in front of you and me, weren't there, in the kind of evening session, who had between them or were working their way through an entire bottle of white wine, which I couldn't help feeling is a little bit of a distraction in itself. You know,
oh God, I'm holding up glasses.
I do feel if you go to a major sporting occasion of any kind, okay, I'm going to throw this out there, a cup final or a test match or whatever. You have a social duty, Mark, not to be pissed.
Absolutely. Okay?
You've got to be there. You've got to be in the moment. You've got to be enjoying it.
Yeah.
If you want to get pissed, go to the pub and get pissed. It's perfectly adequate places you can go and do that.
But
the idea that you should...
Don't annoy and
that
distract you can the people only, sitting behind you.
No, but even regardless of what you're doing to anybody else, what a pathetic reflection on you as a human being. I can only tolerate... This exhibition of athletic prowess at its very highest level.
Yeah.
If I'm half cut, you know what I mean.
And I need to be half cut to remind myself that I'm enjoying myself. But I think it all stems back to the Instagram, as we were saying the other day. Those girls were spending the entire time, and they were mostly girls actually, holding up glasses of rosé, weren't they? photographing them with the royal box in the far distance and with Nadal in the front line or Kyrgios, whoever it was. And they, in order to send to their friends, saying, I've got all this, but at the forefront of the picture, I'm getting absolutely hammered. And you think that is just... Oh.
But also, Mark, what were you also saying when you're doing that kind of thing and you're sending those messages to people? What you're saying is, more important to me than watching Nadal or listening to Bob Dylan, more important to me than being with my friends and having a drink, even more important than that, is showing off to you
that
I'm here and you're not. Yeah. It's just pathetic, you know, on every level. And also, moving along from the two women in front of us, wasn't there a guy along who was actually pretty much broadcasting the match live to a mate of his who was in a car somewhere?
Yeah, he was.
He was following the game on a phone.
Yeah.
And this is a game that's no doubt available on, you know, Five Live or whatever, if you are minded to follow what was
going on. But you want it from your pissed mate. A personal commentary.
Ridiculous, you know.
Just to compound our sense of irritation. Oh, my goodness me. It was incredible.
I think Bob Dylan is entirely right. I can't believe nobody's done it before. And actually, what we ought to move towards is kind of discount or some kind of privileged status for people who don't take phones to gigs.
Yeah.
You can only go in the front 10 rows or something if you don't take phones. You know, you can go with the hoi polloi. That'll be absolutely fine up the back and you ruin each other's fun, but not in the special sections.
But it must be miserable having no sense of personal reaction with anybody at all because they're just so busy filming you. I mean, that must just drive you absolutely crazy.
So while we're talking about favourite subject, which is, you know, the world going to hell in a handcart.
Our speciality subject.
No, it just struck me. You and I were talking this week about, I'd done an interview with Sheila Fogarty, the broadcaster from LBC, who's done a very good little podcast about her unfortunate, terrible experience of being stalked. And nothing really terrible came of it, but it's a horrible experience for anybody to have. And, you know, there's all these stories that Emily Maitlis has had a stalker
dreadful
over 20
story.
Years or
yeah,
something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
And there was a... I happened to see a story in some way yesterday that the Beckhams had a most recent problem with somebody turning up at their daughter's school claiming that they were supposed to be taking her home from school. I mean, this is what I thought, Mark. Is it possible that right now anybody taking any notice of this kind of level of appalling antisocial behaviour, it might result in them, we might develop a generation who of whom not one in their right minds could possibly think that being famous was in any way desirable?
No, not remotely.
Anymore. Could it just stop? You know what I mean? Because if you're a famous footballer or an actor it doesn't happen to rock stars because it's not that famous anymore, actually. Although, it probably does happen to certain ones. Yeah, actually, it does. You know, because the profiles of rock stars are a lot lower than they used to be, aren't they?
Yeah.
Whereas the profiles of film stars and TV stars and footballers and so forth, you know, the attention that is drawn to you is as likely to be malign as benign, isn't it? You know what I mean?
It is.
Will have all kinds of...
I'm trying to remember who it was. At the beginning of lockdown, we talked about, I think it was Robbie Williams, talked about somebody had tweeted saying that they are actually quite enjoying the fact that everyone had to wear a mask because they hadn't been to Sainsbury's for years. And he could go into Sainsbury's with a hat on and a mask and no one knew who he was. And it really brought it home to me how absolutely miserable and how absolutely imprisoned you must be. And that whole thing about being that famous where if you go out the front door, do you just to go and buy a pint of milk? Do you still have to? Are you kind of officially on? Do you have to be cautious about what you wear? And, you know, it's unspeakable misery.
You know, and I think it's fair to say, I think the overwhelming majority of people are perfectly reasonable and wouldn't dream of indulging in trespassing on anybody's space in any way. But you only need to have a significant minority to make the lives of the famous absolutely miserable.
Yeah.
You know, and so many of these cases.
And how much easier it is to do it now. You don't have to necessarily physically turn up and stand on somebody's doorstep. You can just constantly barrage them on social media. Everything they say, you can react to in a vicious and
terrible way. Yeah, well, there's this terrible case. People may have read this. Jeremy Vine was giving evidence.
Oh, God, yeah.
In a case this week where somebody formerly worked in local radio, you know, which is the kind of thing that was... Send a shiver down the spine of anybody who remembers that series of Alan Partridge where, goes into the house where it's covered in
pictures. It's a shrine. It's a shrine. It's a Alan Partridge. Mentalist. Like, oh, that's where the phrase mentalist came from, didn't it?
This case involved loads of, weren't necessarily household names, but they were broadcasters on local radio or whatever. Yeah. Jeremy Vine obviously is a household name, and, so he was the person who was taking it on, I suppose.
Yeah.
And but by God, these people have my sympathy. So that's why you and I, Mark, are so right in keeping up our current level of almost total obscurity.
Invisibly low.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Well, we just interviewed Dave Davies of the Kinks for a pod. And he's just got a book out, which had some extraordinary revelations, called Living on a Thin Line. And he's, just fascinating stuff. Yeah, very interesting about his legacy, wasn't he? I mean, firstly, that's fair enough, and that's not a great surprise, that he thinks that The Who, Hendrix and The Doors, etc., were influenced by the Kinks' early sound, and that The Clash and The Indurian Madness and Blur by the later slightly kind of music hall stuff. And, and he's absolutely right, I think, to feel aggrieved that the Kinks aren't quite accorded that kind of level of respect, probably because they kind of fizzled out slightly as a live act towards the end and never kept themselves in the frame. There's a lot of stuff in the book, isn't there, about the fact that they were let down by their managers when they were touring America, and they were completely unprotected. Larry Page was off kind of producing orchestral versions of their tunes, and I think signing Sonny and Cher rather than being with them and holding their hands every time they played gigs, and so they were having to argue all about the money and settle all the disputes themselves, and they kind of engineered a very grumpy kind of signature, didn't they? Where people just thought we just can't deal with this group, and they were blacklisted, weren't they? Blacklisted eventually from the American tour circuit, And there's a lovely little bit about when Ray, I think, is just suffering from general ill health and exhaustion, and they do a 2-week tour, a European tour, with a Ray Davis stand-in. Remember that bit? And nobody notices. And it's fantastic, isn't it? And lovely stuff. I thought about the whole concept of kinkiness, which is a kind of uniquely mid-60s British, indeed.
Because he said that he always felt that he didn't like the name The Kinks.
No.
Which is kind of ironic, because it's probably one of the key defining characteristics of The Kinks.
It is.
He always thought a better name was The Ramrods.
The Ramrods, that was his first group, The Ramrods.
We wouldn't have been talking about them now if they were called The Ramrods.
No, The Kinks are a great name.
Think about The Kinks, and also just to remind people who aren't as elderly as you and I, is that kinky, and the whole kinky was a whole world in the 60s. You know what I mean? It ranged from kind of boots, it was fashion stuff. It was skirts, it was boots, it was caps also.
Hunting boots, but also jumpers.
It was kinky behaviour in the sense of all that stuff that we would now rather pompously describe as transgressive.
Yeah, absolutely.
In one way or another. In those days, we're just given the kind of the umbrella term kinky. Ooh, that's kinky. And one of the surprising facets to me of the book is that he writes very honestly about the fact that we were very correct if we were, if people at home watching The Kinks doing Well-Respected Man or Dedicated Follower of Fashion or him doing Death of a Clown came to the conclusion that he was more polysexual than it might on the face of it have appeared. They were absolutely right in this, completely.
No, he's very, very keen to point out how energetically what's the word? He was kind of equal opportunities man, wasn't he? Well, he has a major affair with Long John Baldry at one point.
And, but it's more. Listen, David Bowie comes out in 1971 or whatever and says, I'm bisexual. Dave Davis had good reason to say, that's old news,
very
matey.
Old news.
I've been doing that for years.
I know, absolutely. And when we asked him about it, he said, presumably that's something that your press officer was going to keep quiet. He said, well, it was illegal at the time, which you forget, actually.
He was a very good point. It was illegal.
So you kind of think, why wasn't he more open about it? But anybody was open about it on a local level, you know.
Yeah. So here he is just talking about it.
You have, you know, there's a bit where I think you have a love affair with Long John Baldry and things like that. I mean, those kind of things weren't things you talked about in interviews at the time, were they?
No, it was because homosexuality was illegal till 1966.
Yeah.
And in showbiz or the theatre or the arts or all those allied parallel businesses, there was a lot of homosexuality or experimentation,
yeah,
rather than it was quite an eye opener when I realised a lot of, you know, people experimented in the arts that wasn't what they called everyday life, you know, attitudes and sexuality and art. You know, it's all about finding out, searching. That's the whole purpose of art, is finding out, trying out, experimentation.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
That's Dave Davis talking to us about his book, Living on a Thin Line, which is out now. Mark?
Well, I was going to mention Word magazine, because it was 10 years ago, pretty much to the day, wasn't it, that Word magazine closed. And I was going to say to you, and I'm sure you probably feel the same, actually, what mixed feelings I have, because, I mean, obviously it's a great sense of sorrow and regret, but there's also an enormous sense of relief, actually.
Huge.
When people say something's a noble cause, you kind of think,
an uphill struggle.
I can remember when it closed, Andrew Harrison, I don't know if it was a public thing or he just sent it to me as an email, I can't remember, but I've kept it anyway. And Andrew Harrison had this brilliant thing. Andrew Harrison was the kind of features head, one of the main creative engines of the magazine. And he said, Word was like being asked to join the Magnificent Seven. He said there were bad times and the village needed people to defend its values, beliefs and principles. A few old gunmen had come out of retirement for one last job, and in our hearts we knew we were headed for a chest full of lead. But people would write songs about us, and the most beautiful girl in the village would wear black for the rest of her life. If the Word died, it would die with its boots on. I thought that was really good. It reminded me of what kind of harbour you were constantly kind of stopping holes in dams and constantly fighting the tide and constantly trying to kind of keep the whole thing going, you know. I mean, virtually all magazines, you know, have their era. There's an era they define. It Smash Hits or Let It Rock or The Face or Q or whatever. And Word was a kind of snapshot, wasn't it, of 2002 to 2012, you know. And I was very proud of the fact that it was like a little club and it never made you feel bad for liking something or never made you feel unfashionable or awkward or outmoded or whatever. And it tended to cover things it enthused about and forgot about the rest. And I think the fact it was way ahead on things like, about long-form telly and writing about songwriters and not bands, you know, people that you could grow old with, people who got better as they got older, which there aren't that many. You know, Tom Waits, Lucinda Williams, John Prine, Leonard Cohen, Nick Cave, Nick Lowe. It wrote about film directors, not actors, mostly. It wrote about authors, not books. And it was very, very hot on the whole iPod boom, people's appetite for just new tracks, you know. But I miss the people. I don't know how much I miss the magazine. I miss the people. But it was a Dunkirk spirit, wasn't it? You know, I felt very responsible for the sales a lot of the time. You know, you were kind of like the little corner shop in the shadow of the giant mega stores. You know, you had the long shadows of Q and Mojo. And you had to kind of just keep the boat afloat. And I can remember the big triumphs. You know, I can remember. Do you remember the John Peel cover? That was fantastic. John Peel cover pinned up in newsagents. And, you know, the various others, the Roger Waters, the Amy Winehouse, the Joni Mitchell. But one thing I really felt about it was that I miss having made a physical product. I missed the feeling of when it's done and you've got something that you've created, the physical thing, you can leaf through it. What I don't miss was actually working on a physical product because it was so labour intensive. Don't you think, looking back on it now, seems to be less and less appetite for physical products. And just
the proofs,
the spelling, artwork, you know, everything. And the age, particularly the age of podcasts, you record a podcast, you put it up. Do you know what I mean? I mean, that physical labour of handcrafted physical objects, I don't miss that.
When I posted a couple of weeks ago when it was there, I don't know when it was the actual anniversary of when it closed and when the announcement went out, you know, I posted something on Twitter about it. And, you know, lots of people responded. People very nice and very kind, and so forth. But a few people say, can't you get back together again just to do one issue? I felt like I wish I had the home address of these people so I could go around and tell them just how utterly impossible that would be. You know what I mean?
Absolute agony.
Because, you know, it's just, you know, it's hard enough to do something regularly, you know, when you're going uphill. And don't forget, you know, the whole market was an uphill struggle. It didn't matter whether you were Q, Mojo, or The Word, or anybody. They're all suffering exactly the same things, which is there was no growth and there was no advertising, and things were just going backwards. And you were trying to do a thing that, you know, fewer and fewer people had an appetite for. But the idea that you could ever get those people together to do that just once.
It's the Magnificent Men thing. It's the Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, but I said, you know, and I wasn't being kind of flip. I said, if you can find, you know, 2,000 people who would pay £100 each.
Possibly, and pay in advance.
Well, that's the point, yes. And, you know, that is just utterly impossible. The only thing I'd say about
but it was meant
about fun. Word.
That's the sweet thing.
The point about Word. Okay. And that's fine. But this is Word. Every bit as much as that was Word.
It is.
This is it.
Not the same tone. The same kind of editorial.
You know, well, yeah. And you know, we don't have to do the things you used to have to do. I mean, can you, if you've never done it, you know, it's impossible to get through to people just how much dog work, leg work, labour, bureaucracy, politicking, glue sticking, travel, expenses filing, bureaucracy was involved in even an 800-word piece in a print magazine that was done to any kind of standard. You cannot believe how much work there was in those things.
But the beautiful thing is,
feature film levels of work involved in those kind of things, and you do them, and it would come out, and you know, you'd sell a few copies, and then it's just gone.
But the beautiful thing is, they did exist. It exists, and people still have them. But I mean, my God, looking back at it now, it does seem it's a tough old gig, wasn't it?
Well, it's like anything, Mark. It's, you know, I'm sure you could apply this to anything, to pop music, to you know, to sport, to anything. If it's all going well, it's the easiest job in the world.
That's it. If it's not going well,
it's the hardest job in the world.
I really remember overnight. Because you're doing more work for less acclaim, aren't you?
Yes,
and you just can't see that. When we were on Smash Hits in the early 80s, what a what a dream that was, because it was really hard work, but all the time you had this following wind. And every issue seemed to sell more than the last one. And you used to somehow, completely wrongly, think that it sold more because somehow you had produced a more fantastic magazine. That's simply not true. There were just a load of people in the market for it who'd never heard of it, and suddenly they saw Howard Jones on the cover. And said, oh, I like him, I'll buy it. You know? Not necessarily to do with you at all.
No, it helped. So, you know, it's 10 years since the word closed. We have great fondness for it and great fondness for all the people who were fond of it and are still fond of the idea. But, you know, would we go back to cranking out a monthly magazine? There isn't the money in the world that would persuade me to do it. I don't know about you, Mark, but there is not the money in the world.
The Word Podcast, two cocoa tins and a piece of string.
Did you see the story about the Eagles?
I did.
These three chaps are in court in the United States over allegedly stealing a whole load of kind of original lyrics and notes and so forth about the Eagles Hotel California.
I didn't see that story. No,
oh, okay. And trying to... And offering them for sale. And Don Henley, who has, you know, a memory that a Serbian would doff his hat to, you know. Don Henley does... the late Ian Paisley would have recognised one of his own in Don Henley. He does not forget at all. And of course, he is the sole heir, really, isn't he, of the original Eagles. I suppose Joe Walsh and so forth.
So what was stolen? This was...
There's basically, somehow, and the missing bit of the story is a load of material related to Hotel California. Paper, you know, handwritten stuff, notes, I don't know, maybe studio notes, maybe tries at lyrics and all that kind of stuff, was given or somehow found its way into the hands of somebody.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Who was writing a biography of the Eagles, and this is, I think, back in the, well, it's quite a few years ago, this is a few decades ago, and then was presumed to have disappeared. This has somehow found its way in onto the kind of the same market, albeit on a smaller scale, that stolen works of art probably turn up in oligarchs.
I'm sure it is.
In oligarchs' cow sheds.
How are they trying to sell them?
Well, one of them is a curator of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, this is bad.
Yeah.
This is bad.
It's the idea that it's got to court. And the thing that, go and have a look on the New York Times website or whatever, because when I saw a picture of these three guys in court at the early kind of hearings, The Americans have a big thing about kind of public disgrace, and they always put three people through what they call the perp walk, don't they? You know, that the key thing about being arrested is you should be seen to be arrested.
Yeah.
You should be seen going in and out of a courtroom or whatever. These three guys were in court, and they had handcuffed behind their backs, which I thought, for guys who've allegedly half-inched lyrics from Hotel California, is a little
crimes.
Bit heavy-handed. Yeah.
Just in case there had to be anybody else in the courtroom who had a kind of original manuscript of a Leonard Cohen lyric, you know.
Yes,
going to be safe.
You know, you can't imagine what kind of trouble you'd get in if you'd organised an insurrection against the American Constitution. You'd be in a terrible state if that's what happens to you when you walk off with, you know, a copy of Pretty Maids All in a Row from Hotel California. Anyway, that's what's going on in the United States, honestly. You know, it's a crazy, crazy town, crazy people.
Crazy people.
So keep an eye on that one. And also in legal news, I was interested to see that there was a court case. There's always a court case every week of some erstwhile members of a group arguing about who owns the legacy, who's got the rights to trade on the name. You know, is it going to be Led Zeppelin? Is it going to be the Moody Blues? Is it going to be Van Halen? Is it going to be the Sex Pistols? Is it going to be the Clash? Is it going to be the Human League? Or is it the Rubettes?
It's the Rubettes. I love that. Because the idea that there would have been, there was a group, you know, 49 years ago in kind of fiercely creased white flared trousers with giant lapels and absurd collars and feather cut haircuts, you know, and an entire soap opera could be written about the backstabbing, deceit, attrition, chicanery, skullduggery involved in this group, the Rubettes. Reminds you that actually every single group, doesn't matter what group they are and what level they're operating on, has a completely unique story, doesn't it? Because in this case, the story is, I think, is it Alan Williams the singer, right?
Something like that.
And Alan Williams did not write Sugar Baby Love, which is what the whole issue's about, because it's still quite a big hit and makes a lot of money. Didn't write it. Was the manager of the group. Was accused by the others of being kind of heavy-handed and very secretive about the cash the band received, etc., wasn't he? And the others were involved in a clandestine and secret plan to split from him. And it's all, I mean, it's just, you have no idea who's right, who's wrong, whatever. And it's the Rubettes, for Christ's sake.
It would be really good to have a Friday night BBC 4 serious documentary that pretended it was the Clash, but actually it was about the Rubettes.
You know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The great truth is all groups are the same.
All groups are the same.
Completely the same.
Completely.
And, you know, well, we were talking to Graham Goldman, weren't we, about this, you know, when he, at our Word in the Park thing the other week. And Graham goes out and performs as 10cc.
Well, he used to go out as Graham Goldman's 10cc, but he said he went out on this tour and he just thought, I'll tell you what, I'm just going to call it 10cc and see what happens. And everyone's gone very quiet. So that's fine. And quite rightly, because, I mean, you know, for God's sake, if he wants to do it, let him do it. The only reason they're
absolutely
not involved with it is they don't want to do it themselves. He's got every right.
No,
he's the founder of the group and writer of most of the songs. Whereas
absolutely.
This guy's just had to be the singer of a band whose most of his material was written by other people. It's amazing.
It's amazing. So I was
Manny
amazed.
Charlton, we should mention Charlton.
Manny Charlton.
Manny Charlton, who I interviewed in 1978.
Out of Nazareth, this is, of course, the guitarist out of Nazareth. Of
He was the guitar player. Yeah, Dan McCafferty, was it? Was the singer? That's right.
Was the singer, yes.
Yeah. No, he died, and I can remember being sent up by the NME in 1978 to interview Nazareth. I mean, I was desperate to do Crispy Ambulance or, you know what I mean, A Certain Ratio or the Teardrop Express. But no, I was very much at the bottom of the food chain. It's Funkapolitan, all happening in New South. So I sent up on a private aircraft to the Isle of Man, and I've told you this before, it was so brilliant. It was just
sorry, hold on. I've never heard private aircraft before. Tell me, what was the private aircraft? From where?
Prime Minister. It was from, where did we go from? London. We went from London with the management of the group. Who else was on the plane? I can't remember. Photographer, me. Very small plane, straight to the Isle of Man.
So not a scheduled flight.
It was in a private aircraft. And I can remember, I know, and I can remember that that's the amount of money Nazareth must be making at the time. And the fact that living on the Isle of Man was the fact they were tax exiles. And as I told you before, it was like Stella Street, because in the same road, there were members of Status Quo coming out to get their milk bottles, you know. Just down the street, there were these hairy old guys. And what struck me about Manny Chandler as interesting was he was mortified by punk rock. I mean, really, really miserable.
I'm sure.
The rug had been comprehensively pulled from under his feet. You know, his entire career appeared to be over, which I suppose in sense with Nazareth it was. You know, and he was just he just felt redundant and miserable and couldn't help complaining about it. But no, I thought he was an interesting guy, because the interesting pop fact was that Guns N' Roses, Axl Rose, etc., loved Nazareth, didn't they?
Yeah.
And they loved a particular track. Was it The Hair of the Dog, I think. And if you listen to Hair of the Dog,
wasn't it?
Dan McCafferty was that. I think it's a track on the album. And Dan McCafferty sounds exactly like Axl Rose. And so they said, let's get the guy who produced this.
Oh,
in.
Really? Yeah.
And they got him in. Actually, he did produce 25 tracks, I think, of Manny Charlton. But he just didn't have the time to finish the whole project, and somebody else brought in the end. But he was the basic, he did the basic groundwork for the sound of Guns N' Roses. So, you know, the Nazareth legacy, Dave, lives on.
Can I just remind ourselves here of how strange it was? You know, Nazareth's big hits were, Mark Ellen, over to you. Do you know what they were?
Go on, I don't think I can.
They did a version of Love Hurts, didn't they?
Oh,
the
yes,
old
they
ballad.
Did.
Yeah, it's kind of Everly Brothers' song, isn't it?
Yeah.
Love Hurts, Love Hurts, Love Scars, It Wounds and Mars.
Yeah.
All that thing. And the other thing, even more surprising, because when I was just refreshing my memory about this morning, I thought, did that really happen? Yes, it did. Nazareth's big hit was their version of Joni Mitchell's This Flight Tonight.
My God, yes.
But you remember?
Yeah.
You know,
what a bizarre choice for a kind of gritty Scottish hard rock band.
And they did a, you know, kick-ass version.
Yeah.
Of Joni Mitchell's, you know, none more kind of introspective. This Flight Tonight.
Also, they are another indication of the enormous influence of the band, aren't they? The band,
yes.
the group that split up Cream when they heard it, there's no point carrying on. The group that, without whom, Fairport Convention would never have become the Fairport Convention that they did, because they want to be kind of an English version.
They
of
want
the,
to be the band. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But also Nazareth, who called themselves Nazareth after the character in the lyric, the band lyric, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
Welcome to another a little birthday special. The very first person we had actually doing a birthday special podcast, whatever it was, 2 years ago, I think, Alan Williams. Alan, lovely to see you again and happy birthday. And you've been, I think, continuing your energetic hunt for Hypnosis album sleeves.
Yeah, well, I think we spoke about this last year and you asked me if I was trying to collect them all and I was a bit evasive, but I think I realised this year I am trying to collect them all.
Oh, he's coming out.
Right, yeah. And so how many are there and how many have you got?
Well, I think that I've got a book that they publish which lists all the actual Hypnosis ones, and there's about 370 perhaps of them.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
but then there's all the things that Storm Thorgerson went on to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's perhaps 500 or something. And
Can we ask how many you've got?
Probably about 150, something like that.
That's fantastic.
Oh, it's a long way to go. It's a decent start. So what have you acquired most recently?
Well, I mean, I've really enjoyed, sort of since lockdown ended, been able to go out and about shopping a lot. And most weekends we've managed to sort of stumble on secondhand record shops or charity shops. So,
So you're not buying these online. You're actually going into shops and just hoping there'll be
a few old
Ainsley Dunbar's Retaliation record.
Yeah, going to shops. I mean, for a birthday treat last Sunday, we went up to Chesterfield where there was a record fair actually on Chesterfield Market, an open air one. It was really lovely.
So this is your birthday treat, an open-air record fair at Chesterfield.
Yeah, quite a good haul up there. So, but yeah, I've got a few interesting things this year. I mean, this was one I got in London.
Oh, my God, Free Creek.
Yeah, so I mean, I didn't know anything about this, but it seems to be a set of sessions. It's got all sorts of people.
Yes.
Keith Emerson,
yeah.
Mitch Mitchell. I think Eric Clapton's on there, Linda Ronstadt, Todd Rundgren.
God, I have not seen that record for 40 years.
Hold up the sleeve again. Let's have another look.
Yeah, it's a gatefold as well. So.
It's called Music from Free Creek, it was called,
that's
wasn't
amazing.
It? Something kind.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think what it was kind of sessions where these people came together, but they weren't really official things that their record companies had approved.
No.
I read
it's somebody gold over a load of tapes and thought, I'm going to put this out. So well, that's me. Good. So that what else you got?
Good find. I've got Halloween.
God, I've never seen that.
Heard of that.
Ones.
Yeah.
I quite like that because where are we? Just there, I'm pretty sure that is actually Storm Thorgerson. It looks rather like
that's
him.
That's such a hypnosis image, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so Pink Floyd. Yeah.
There. So that was a good find. I thought that was a good one.
God.
The rainbow.
Yes. Snapping on the gloves.
And then there was a good book came out this year. Aubrey Powell did a new book telling some of the stories behind...
has that come out? Okay.
Yeah, it's quite a nice sort of Dark Side of the Moon themed thing. But it's got quite a lot of detailed stories about the sort of lavish photo shoots they went on. And he talks at great length about this one.
Oh, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Which cost a fortune, didn't it?
Yeah, this was a statue that McCartney owned, and he said to Aubrey Powell, "We want to take a picture of that." So it was either the Matterhorn or the Eiger.
Yeah.
They couldn't actually get there. But basically, they chartered helicopters and flew this thing out at great expense. And then I think when they got it back and showed McCartney, he said, "Oh, you could have just done that in the studio."
And that was
and here's
that
your
was
bill.
And that's the turning point, isn't it? Because that's the amazing thing about hypnosis stuff, particularly the early stuff, is... They did it. They actually did it. If you want a load of balls in the North African desert for the nice album Elegy, I think it wasn't it? You took a load of balls out to the North African desert and you inflated them and you photographed them.
The idea
you chased
now
them
that
around.
You would have to inflate a giant pig and physically fly it over Battersea Power Station seems absolutely absurd, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Although even that one, they had to do it in more than one day because the sky wasn't right or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was comped together.
Yeah.
From two sessions. So that was the kind of beginning of the age of fakery we live in now. So those are ones you've acquired. You know, what's your kind of holy grail of hypnosis album covers? What's the one you really want? Might be somebody out there who's got one.
Yeah, I think that there's a couple by a group called Flash that are quite...
Oh, right, of course. Steve Pete Banks out of Yes.
Yes.
Was it? Well done, though. That's very good.
Yeah.
Very impressive.
There's a few of the Pink Floyd ones I need. I mean, you find those quite often, but they tend to be a little bit overpriced because it's Pink Floyd. So I just, if I see a good Barbie one, I will. But it's some of the more obscure ones are quite interesting. One thing, I know you're always interested in how people itemize their or store their records.
Oh, right, go on.
I took the radical decision. I thought I'm going to have a separate hypnosis section. So to about there. Along, that's all the hypnosis.
So how many yards
that's
of hypnosis?
Very advanced, that is.
Yeah.
That's really good.
So it's easier to find them.
Yeah.
This is what I've been looking out for and I found in Manchester a few...
Oh, well, of course.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a compilation. It's got various people. It's got a bit of Kevin Ayers and there's a bit of Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
I just think that's sort of typical of their photo style, really.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think, it's from very early 70s. But, and there's a kid on the back staring at a dead crow or something.
There you go.
So
there
commercial. So uplifting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, keep your quest going, Alan. And, we should no doubt come back next year to see
see the next yard.
If you've gone further up. Yes.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Word Podcast, where the time is whenever you want it to be.
So, Alex, it's a red letter day on planet Indy, isn't it? You've all got the bunting out and the hats on the side of your head. Small children are
bucket hats on the side of our head.
Why are you celebrating, Alex? Why is the Le Tout planet Indy en fête? Why is it? Why?
Well, it's Nolmus. Because it's the 25th anniversary of a seminal Oasis record, Be Here Now, which is approximately 4 days of unbridled ear-destroying joy.
So are people swinging around lampposts and clicking their heels and stranger kissing stranger, that kind of thing?
Well, actually, there's a lot of... Be Here Now is a big question mark, as you probably know very well, because it is... You know, you can't. You start listening to it, and you finish listening to it. You've grown several beards in that space of time. And, you know, you just listen to half a song, and you get high. I mean, that's the level of chemical overindulgence that was involved in the making of that record.
But also, the general consensus is it was dismal rubbish, wasn't it?
Well,
isn't that the general feeling? Do you know what I mean? Stand By Me. All around the world, this is not the first album, Magic.
Well, I suppose, surely. You know, lead single was, do you know what I mean, wasn't it? And that's 7 minutes long. And the first minute of that, bear in mind this is the lead single of the track, the first minute of this song is helicopter noise and Morse code for a minute. Oh, and the chorus doesn't come in for about 3 minutes, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely, it's just a complete kind of, you know, it's outlandish to say the least. But I think that Be Here Now is going to go undergo a bit of a revision, you know.
All right. Okay.
Go on, well, fighting talk. Good luck with that.
Well, it's kind of a marker point of a particular era, isn't it? And, you know, at that point, there was only one way for Oasis to go, and that was bigger and more overblown and more overindulged. And it delivered on all those points. And the problem,
in a good
there's some absolute gold in there. I think there's a track two on the record is a track called My Big Mouth, and it's fantastic. It just sounds like you're being thrown through a wind tunnel. It's just so dynamic. It's brilliant. It's got one of Liam's best vocals, I think. But it's the whole record is swimming in 18 layers of guitars. The tracks are too long. It wasn't edited. There's no real bass frequency on the record. I think what Owen Morris, who's the producer, did, he mixed it having taken out a lot of the low, and so it's very mid-rangey. And for those who kind of aren't really au fait with studio-y kind of terms, it sounds a little bit dirgy because of that. There's no kind of differentiation between, there's no clarity there. But there was some really, really great stuff involved in all that. And I think, you know, at the time, the hype didn't help because it could never, ever, 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 ever live up to all the hype it was being given. You know, it was basically being held as humanity's greatest gift since our inception as a species.
By everybody? Or...
Can I put my hand up at this point? Because I didn't, but a lot of people did.
But that's how it was sold, wasn't it?
Well, the interesting thing about Oasis to me in that whole era was that the country was kind of drunk on itself. That's my memory of it at the time. They're the biggest band in the world. No, they weren't. You know what I mean? They were the biggest band in the UK, undoubtedly. But Britain was very kind of high on itself at the time, you know, in lots and lots of respects, and they were kind of classics out of that. So, okay, well, you've mounted your passionate defence, and we shall see whether there is a massive reinvestigation of this 25 years on. Talking of the passing of time and Planet Indy, Alex, you posted me the other day, you concerned that Dave Grohl, a man about whom you will not have anything said that is in any way negative, had reached a particular milestone in his life. Go on, explain this.
Okay, well, Dave Grohl has now officially hit the Meldrew point. Now, the Meldrew point is is when you are the exact age that Richard Wilson was when he first started playing Victor Meldrew, which is 19,537 days old, which in layman's terms is 53 and a bit. But they've got almost past that point now, and I still won't hear a negative thing said about him.
That's misleading because he was playing a much, much older man, wasn't he? But it's amazing he's 53.
But it's interesting. So there you go. So Clive Dunn was how old when he first played Corporal Jones in Dad's
Army? Probably 38 or something. I don't know.
40. He was 48. He was pretty much the youngest of the main cohort of Dad's Army cast, apart from Ian Lavender and so forth. So Dave Grohl is now 53, which means that he's now 1 year too old to play Paul McCartney's grandfather in Hard Day's Night. Because when Wilfred Bramble appeared in Hard Day's Night
as
Paul's grandfather,
who
was the epitome of everything elderly and I fought in the war for the likes of you all that.
Missing teeth, probably.
He was 52 years old. Now, he had admittedly a character actor and he'd always played older. But he's still, if you want to do a kind of picture of a disapproving grandfather figure, Wilfred Bramble in Hard Day's Night,
so
in
the
railway
younger than
carriage,
Richard Wilson. That's fantastic.
Does the job. He's younger than Richard Wilson.
Oh, that's so great.
And younger than Dave Grohl is to this day.
Also 53, Marilyn Manson. They're not getting any younger. Nicky Wire, James Dean Bradfield. I think I've just become Graham Coxon. It's happening. A lot of them.
Well, the alternative is not attractive, is it, really? So get older. Everybody, all the cool kids are doing
it's
it.
What they're
getting
all doing.
Older. So, what have we been doing recently? Have we got new patrons, Alex? Anything we ought to tell people about?
We do. We've got some new people to welcome to the fold, and they are
let's do that.
Sid D.
Hello, Sid. Very nice to hear you.
Nick Gould,
come on down.
The fantastically named Lance Rifle.
Oh, that's Lance, right, that's excellent.
That can't be real. That's
is that recovered real? That's
a
regiment.
I like to think it's real.
That's a really good name.
We want to know if it's real.
Parents
or not.
And the wonderful, wonderfully monosyllabic Pam.
Good for Pam.
You're all very, very welcome. And if anybody would like to join at this host of right-thinking, right-acting individual. The place to do it is patreon.com/wordinyourear, and you find out where you'd like to come in on that particular relationship ladder, shall we call it that?
Ooh, that's
what else have we been doing recently? We did a fantastic Word in Your Ear the other day with Bruce Finlay.
Oh, he was so
Who's
good.
Bruce Phenomenal. Finlay, people say. I'm saying Bruce is a figure unique in British music business history.
He is. He is because he's the person most closely associated with the name of a record shop, isn't it? Bruce's Records from Edinburgh.
Bruce's Records.
Of the many branches all over Scotland, in fact.
Absolutely. And I'm trying to think. There was Andy's in Cambridge, wasn't there? There was Andy's in Cambridge. And presumably there was an Andy. But Bruce always had a bit of a profile because he went on and he managed Simple Minds and did loads of things like that.
That was so interesting.
Fantastic.
Just the little details. One detail was saying that record companies used to put out their albums to coincide with the first week of the college grant. Because people had more money. It was great. They also used, in the shops, you had a little rack called Bruce's Nice Sounds, where you'd have Miles Davis and the Incredible String Band and all sorts of all variety.
So he talks about the extraordinary stories about the golden days of the LP trade. He talks about the weekend when he went out on a limb and ordered 500 copies of the first album by an unknown group, and I'm not going to tell you who the group is.
And he sold them all.
And by the time he was halfway through Saturday, he'd rung up to get more. And if you want to know who the group was, and loads of other stories like that, make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel. And if you haven't already done that, make sure you do that, because that'll be coming up very soon, along with other unmissable stuff.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.